Mitesh, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I guess, could you give us a bit of an introduction to yourself, please?
Yeah, so my name is Mitesh Vilani. Thanks for having me, guys. I guess my background is I'm a chartered accountant, trained with Deloitte. I've run various businesses since coming out of Deloitte. I think I did mergers and acquisitions there for a year or so, trained in audit, came out, and then I've got this kind of entrepreneurial spirit or bug that sort of possessed me and took control. I think back in sort of 2004, I started up a food business, ran that for 3 years, didn't make much money, made back my capital costs, I guess. 2008 hit, market collapsed. I went into sport for 10 years because that's my other passion. So I started writing to sort of cricket clubs and rugby clubs and football clubs up and down the country. Landed a FD position at Saracens Rugby Club in 2010. I was there 10 years, worked all the way up to CEO, was CEO for 3 years. And then the kind of entrepreneurial business bug hit again. Started a property development company about 3 years ago. I'm doing something else in food at the moment, a franchise business. I started working as an advisor for a sports tech business. I'm also doing sort of some consultancy work in sport as well. So I guess fairly broad brushed, well-rounded, I would consider it maybe. Yeah. But always looking for different opportunities and not a, I guess I'd class myself as not a traditional CFO. Mm-hmm. You know, I love analytics, I love data, I love numbers, but I'm always striving for innovation, especially where technology is going these days. So hopefully that's a kind of a snippet in terms of where I've got to and where I am today.
Why finance?
I love numbers, I think. Yeah. And I really see numbers as a more of an art form, actually. I mean, I did maths at university, and actually pure maths, but you know, I like that form of measure and that ability to take something and analyze it and lift up from the numbers and then have some sort of, analytical views on the numbers and where they're going and how we extrapolate and then what we do and the actions we take from those numbers. So that's, I guess, why finance was a kind of natural progression for me. ACA, I think it's just because I'm interested in business and I'm interested in how businesses grow. Maybe it's my background, kind of quite an Asian background where, you know, a lot of people, my cousins or brothers, sisters go into kind of finance, law, medicine, maybe a little bit more vocational courses as well. But, you know, that's where it kind of stopped. I didn't want to go into banking, but I wanted to come out and do a more kind of entrepreneurial type of career path.
Yeah.
Talk about the entrepreneurial career path. And I guess it sounds like you started a business that didn't necessarily go the way you would ideally have wanted it in the food business. How did you kind of, what did you take from that? And I guess, what did it give you for then your future career as well?
Yeah, I think if you look at the career path of a CFO, it's very much maybe ACA, CIMA, ACCA, whatever it is, through a professional service sort of firm, and then into market, industry, maybe into banking if you're in that sector, or manufacturing, or whatever it might be. And I think kind of taking that turning point and going and starting something myself was, in my opinion, invaluable because it gave me the ability to understand things from a different perspective, maybe a left field perspective. We were hiring people on minimum wage, which is completely different to dealing with someone who's, you know, a professional ACA qualified coming out of a, you know, Russell Group University. So, and the ability to then, you know, liaise with, motivate those type of people, understand where they come from and background is something that's quite invaluable. And I think that's probably the best learning I took from it is in terms of how you motivate different types of people.
Yeah. Did you see it as a failure in terms of maybe it didn't go to the great expectations you would have had for the business? And did that help you learn emotionally had to kind of cope with those challenges, sort of that personal resilience stuff. Is there anything else emotionally you took from running a business and then maybe having to take a different path?
Yes, definitely. I mean, you know, it impacts your kind of home life as well. So 2008, I was getting married, I was trying to buy a property with my then fiance. But I wasn't earning any money, and I could have earned decent money at Deloitte. So, you know, you're taking this kind of leap, and it is a bit of a leap of faith. But I wouldn't have it any other way. Mm. But there are stresses and strains involved with it. And I've done it several times. Mm. So 2008, probably again in 2020, and then COVID hit. So I think the learnings that you get out of it are completely different to if you were working for someone else. And I think that's, you know, it's really important. And I actually think that as an employer now, I value that from employees more than anything else. Mm. Everyone should start a business. Actually, I do think everyone should start a business, as you guys have as well. But equally, it might be, you know, if someone's in the manufacturing industry, why can they not pivot into the tech industry and do something? Or why can they not pivot into the arts industries? Or, you know, and the learnings you get from pivoting that career are far more valuable in terms of if whether you're in employment or whether you're self-employed than if you're in the same industry for 20 years. Mm. And I actually think that the recruitment industry is a little bit behind it on that basis. And they have to catch up with what's happening globally. And when we look at, you know, maybe China or India and certainly US in terms of Silicon Valley and how they do things, we've got a lot of catching up to do. And when we look at the labour market and the UK workforce, you know, 5-10 years from now, what's that going to look like? Mm. And I think that's something that I think even government should be looking at.
Mm. What do you think the recruitment sector can do better?
Just have, I guess, a little bit more of a less tick box exercise in terms of the candidates that they're looking for.
Yeah.
You know, if you have a candidate that's, you know, it shouldn't be, well, you need to have run a business that's 20 million turnover or 50 million turnover or 100 million turnover and, you know, 50 staff or 100 staff. Or, you know, it's got to be, you know, what challenges have you faced and how have you overcome those challenges? And, you know, and when you look at CVs, it's very vanilla and it's difficult to get those things out there. And but getting in front of people and about people telling their stories and getting an understanding of how that person impacted other people's lives or vice versa, I think that makes you a better person. That makes you more equipped to run a business and deliver growth and success. So I think, you know, I think those are probably the things that recruitment consultants need to get kind of under the skin of. Mm. And it's very difficult to do because everyone's trying to fill a role and get a fee. Mm. So look, I don't have the answer to that question. Yeah. And I think maybe it's a business opportunity.
Yeah. I think it's tricky though, isn't it? You have clients. Clients are very prescriptive. Mm. Clients are very risk averse. In candidate-driven markets, they have a pick and choose across many, many areas. And I think, a lot of the times you can push back a client and say, do they really need 15 years retail experience for this job? Or do they really need X, Y, Z? It's interesting. We had David on the podcast recently, David Brammer, and we were just talking about skills-based hiring being a theme in 2024. And maybe that will be something that becomes more, you know, happens more often. But ultimately, he still went through a 7-stage process recently for a job, got to the end of it, even though they had a discussion at the start saying, look, we're looking at people outside our sector. We want to broaden our horizons. We want people with different lenses and get to the final stage. And they said, look, we're going to give it to someone else who's got 10 years experience in the sector.
Yeah. Mm.
And so it is difficult as a recruiter. I mean, you can, as you say, you can take a horse to water.
Yeah.
I think one of the things we've done, which and where we've shown it to work, is using video interviewing. So we do that extensively now with our clients. And there was an example we had maybe 12, 18 months ago where a client said, yeah, want retail, need retail experience. And ultimately through the market map and the talent map that we produced and taking people through a process, it actually ended up that the candidate that they selected was not from retail at all, but was from insurance. And that was off the back of them effectively meeting the person on camera, yes, in a controlled environment, but actually seeing what that person was about, how they communicate, some of the challenges that they'd face. So I think that's something where, an example where video can be really compelling.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I think the other thing is, just extending that a little bit, is the character of the person involved. So, you know, that's not a tick box exercise. Mm. It's not, I've done this and I've run this. You know, it might evolve from that, but we did something at Saracens, which was quite interesting. So when we recruited a player and we had very strong values within the club, and that player had to fit into those values. And instead of, you know, the first thing we did was invite the player across with the player's partner or wife or girlfriend or whatever it might be. And we often had a coffee with the girlfriend or the partner and wife first, or certainly, you know, individually without the player. And that gives you an interesting perspective into the life of that player and whether they would actually fit into the mold of, say, a family-centric club or not. And, you know, I'm not saying that every employer should interview not only the employee but also partner. But, you know, there is something to be said about, you know, the home life and, you know, the way you were brought up and what you've done and challenges you've faced. And, you know, maybe it should be outside of those, you know, certainly within, if you've got seven interviews for a job, you should have the time to actually go and work out, you know, what this guy is like or what this girl is like outside of work.
That's become quite widely adopted now, hasn't it? In sport, but in particular, clubs. I'm a Norwich City season ticket holder for my sins, but they talk a lot about, you know, players needing to match the value set and needing to be the right kind of person for the dressing room. You know, if you think about any business being like any competitive sports team, it makes sense, doesn't it? That you would want your board to be a competitive, diverse, inclusive, high-performing team in the same way that footballers and rugby, I guess, has done that over the last kind of 5-10 years as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, that those learnings are mirrored and transmitted quite a lot as well between sport and business. And it's been done a number of times. And we launched something called the Saracen's Way. Was launched by, I think, a player called Neil de Kock, and then taken up by a chap called Will Fraser, who still runs a business in that sector now. And you know, it's about that ability to bounce back from failure, that ability to motivate individuals, you know, get the dressing room up, you know, when you're down. That is definitely, you know, transferable into business. I mean, a lot of businesses, I think we had contracts with sort of Tesco's and, you know, a lot of kind of businesses that were looking at bringing those players in and the way that we learnt and the way that we motivated our players and our wider staff. So I think that's been done quite a bit and it needs to be done more.
We haven't really talked about Saracens much other than in your intro. What was that journey like? Because obviously you'd started your own business before that. So it sounds like you carved that opportunity out for yourself by contacting lots of people, which not everyone does, to secure a role. So tell us how that came about and talk about your journey there a little bit.
I think, look, Saracens went from a club that was ground sharing with Watford Football Club at Vicarage Road in 2010. You know, the first kind of mandate from the board was go and find your home ground. Chief exec at the time was Edward Griffiths. He was an Arsenal fan. I was an Arsenal fan. We got on really well. And, you know, I landed that job as the sort of, I think it was FC or FD at the time. And then kind of worked up from there. But, you know, I think we had a massive shift. A chap called Brendan Venter, who was director of rugby at the time, sort of a huge shift in culture. You know, got rid of tens of players in terms of work ethic, and the character that I spoke about didn't fit the character of the club. Brought in, you know, new characters that fit within the mold, defined our values, and then went on a real journey. And I think, you know, and I think that journey was the thing that resonates for me more than anything is about people. So, you know, and you've got to keep people together for, you know, a minimum of 5 years. You know, if you can, I was there for 10 years, but if you can keep people for 10 years, the right people, obviously, then, you know, you're really onto something and things will shift and things will move. And so it's that kind of longevity of quality of people that I learned from there. Just in terms of my own progression, you know, working hard and, you know, work ethic and work rate, as we called it at Saracens, is, you know, comes as a given. You know, it's about putting in the hours. It's about kind of, but also working quite intelligently. You know, we were very good at looking at the market. We were very good at innovation. We set up, you know, 9 global partner clubs. We built a 10,000-seater stadium. I myself did, you know, 2 planning applications in Greenbelt to build a 100,000-square-foot stand. One of the things I did as CEO was I went to the States and looked at how, you know, a lot of American sports, you know, run models. And we played Newcastle Falcons at Philadelphia Eagles Stadium. Sorry, not the Philadelphia Union Stadium, the MLS Stadium. And when I was out there, I went to the Eagles and I went to the NHL team there and very quickly worked out that a lot of, you know, these stadia are funded by municipalities. So they put money in, it creates business, it creates jobs. And so I went back to Barnet Council and says, look, I want to build a 100,000 square foot stand. Will you lend me £23 million to build this stand in conjunction with Middlesex University, who will sit as the anchor tenant on a 30-year lease and run their sports, London Sports Institute out of it and their midwifery department. And so that back-to-back deal worked really well. And that triangle of sports club, council, and university works really well. And, you know, and that could be replicated across sports clubs up and down the country. So I guess we were always looking for different ways of doing that. And I think, you know, pushing those boundaries, I think it comes from being entrepreneurial. And I think it's really important where we got to in the end.
Did you want to be a CFO/CEO, or did that just happen natural conclusion?
I think it was a natural conclusion. The CEO at the time, after Christmas, was Heath Harvey. He left. He came from the FA. He was only there for 2 years. And I kind of stepped into his shoes on an interim basis. I was given it by the board for 6 months and then was made permanent CEO. So I think it was a bit of a natural progression. It was circumstance based on Heath leaving. But I think, you know, I think, again, it's about timing, and it's about kind of, if you push boundaries and you put yourself in the right places, then, you know, things will happen. You know, good things will happen, bad things will happen. But, you know, as long as you keep going, I think, you know, the trajectory will be right.
And we speak to a lot of people who are CFOs and potentially aspiring to be a COO or a CEO in the future. What, from your experience, what advice would you have for someone making that transition?
I think, look, have multiple strings to your bow. So, you know, don't, I talked a little about that linear career path and not having a linear career path. Definitely do that. You know, go and do other things that might be, you know, in education, it might be flipping to a different industry, it might be starting a business, it might be something in charity. Like, all of these things are learnings that are vital when you get into C-suite level. And if you can demonstrate that, and if you've done that over 10, 15 years, then you will have learned a lot of invaluable lessons to when you become a, you know, a chief exec. So I think that that's really important. And I think that that stands you in good stead when things go wrong. And I think, you know, and things will go wrong, and you know, and if you've got those different learnings, then you'll, I guess, your toolkit will be better placed to actually deal with those things as a chief exec.
And in the toolkit for CEO versus CFO, where did you have to grow most?
I think probably the ability to be in multiple places and on multiple calls at, you know, at the same time. You know, it's not physically possible, but your mind has to be in different places. And just having that and juggling that is very, very difficult, because the number of stakeholders that you have to address and you're responsible to just, you know, multiplies overnight. Mm. And I think that's a really difficult skill set to have. Mm. And I actually think that, you know, you certainly can't learn it from a textbook. And the only way to learn it is when you're in the job. Mm. And where that has a real, really strong impact is then at home. So, you know, as Saracen CEO, I was away every weekend, home away game, then into quarterfinals, semifinals, and finals. So, you know, I do have two young children, so, you know, you have to try and balance that at home. And that is really difficult to do. I think, you know, and you only really can do it through learning through your mistakes.
Mm. I guess sport in itself, that is an incredibly difficult one, in that, as you say, you are committed to stays away trips, etc., which isn't the same as every job. It's kind of unique, isn't it? Different stresses, but
yeah,
unique in the in relating to sport.
But where it synergies with other industries, I guess what I'm trying to articulate is that, you know, it's about being in the moment.
Yeah.
So, you know, we talk a lot about that at sports, actually. So, you know, in the moment. So, you know, when you've got the ball, you've got, you know, half a second to get rid of it. You have to be in that moment and make that decision instantly. And I guess it comes from, you know, instincts. It comes from training. But the same thing applies when you're, you know, in business. So every time you do something, you should be in the moment of when you're doing that particular thing. So if it's at home and you're 2 hours with your kids, then, you know, we have something at home where when you come through the front door, you have a phone box and you post your phone through your phone box. And for those 2 hours, 6 to 8 or whatever it is, you're not allowed to touch your phone. You're not allowed to look at your phone. So you're in the moment. You're having dinner with your family. You know, at the same time, if you're at a business meeting at 8 o'clock, you know, you don't take phone calls while you're in a meeting with someone else. You know, my wife often says, like, when you're out for dinner with someone, you wouldn't, you know, you shouldn't have your phone on the table. Like, you don't go for dinner with someone and then, you know, have a book and then you read a page of the book while you're kind of having dinner and having a conversation. So why should you have your phone there flicking onto it? So, you know, it's those kind of things where I call it in the moment. But if you can apply yourself, and there's lots of books written on this, I guess, but if you can apply yourself to be completely, you know, into what you're doing, you'll have the best possible outcome. Mm. And, you know, and it should be kind of short bursts of that intense.
It's a really good, I think, discipline to learn, probably, and I'm sure you've taken it forward into now working for yourself again. Yeah. Once you've got it and once you know what kind of blocking time, working in a kind of a flow state, focusing on one task can help you achieve, you kind of don't go back. I don't think you do. I presume you've taken that forward.
No, it becomes, it becomes ingrained.
Yeah.
I guess it's like muscle memory in sport, right? So, you know, you understand, and you look, as you mature, I'm early 40s now, but as you mature, you kind of understand yourself a little bit better. It's not the same for everyone. People have different levers that they pull to get the best out of themselves. And you understand different levers to pull to get the best out of other people as well. So I think it's about maturity. It's about learning. But maybe it goes back to my point around sort of diversity in your skill set and what you've learned. And if you've got that, you can come to a better conclusion. You can understand yourself better. And you can certainly, you know, you can certainly give more output, or your output is far, far better than if you don't understand those things.
Yeah. I definitely need a box to put my phone in at home in the evenings. I think my other half would say that.
I think it's, I've noticed it in culturally in Spain, having spent some time there, that actually it's really frowned upon to have your phone out on the table in any dinner. They just don't do it at all.
Yeah.
And culturally, if you're out with your kids and you're in a playground, you don't look at your phone. If you do, someone will comment at you in Spanish saying, why are you looking at your phone? Yeah. You're in a playground with your kid.
Yeah.
So We're not very good at that.
Tricky, isn't it? No. It's a by nature addictive device designed to get our attention.
Yeah.
And I think when you layer on top of that entrepreneurialism and running your own business and, you know, rightly or wrongly, you miss that call and it costs X or something happens or you miss an emergency call. It's a challenge. I'm not saying it's right, but you know, you can see where the
but you know, I'm not talking about, you know, don't touch your phone for days on end, right? An hour or 2 hours. It doesn't cost that much.
No.
You know, and I think, you know, when you come back to it and you've been off for 2 hours, your productivity is up in the hour that you're on it. Because you've stepped away from it. You know, often, you know, when people are solving problems, you know, and they, you know, if they're ingrained in it for an hour, you know, take a break, come back, and you'll suddenly solve the problem. And it's a similar sort of mindset.
Yeah,
could argue it might cost you more in a divorce.
you obviously mentioned things will go wrong.
Yeah.
2019, obviously, you experienced adversity at the club, the fine, points deduction, the relegation. Yeah. Talk us through. That must have been difficult, and how you reflect on that, and what you learn from that.
Look, it's really difficult. It was very difficult from a personal level. I was chief exec. You know, there was, you know, I sat 5 days in a disciplinary hearing in Fleet Street. I wrote 2 witness statements. I was cross examined by a QC for, I know, 2 of those 5 days. I don't know if you guys have ever sat in court, but you know, this is not obviously a criminal court, but it's run in much the same way, chaired by Lord Dyson. So again, I talk back to kind of experiences. And you know, it's really easy to run something when everything's going well and you're winning trophies, or you know, the P&L's kind of going up in one direction and you're growing, but you know, when things go wrong, and they go badly wrong, I guess it's when your learning is at the steepest. And then it becomes around, how do you deal with that adversity? How do you, you know, your communication strategy, your, you know, speaking to players, other stakeholders, fans. And I think for me, it was always a case of, you know, we're looking at all the things that we've done and how can we do them better and how do we learn from those mistakes. You know, did Saracens make mistakes? Absolutely, 100%. You know, governance, things around communication between board and owner and staff and chief exec, you know, there were breakdowns in those communications. But equally, you know, when you're doing so well, everyone's there to bring you down. And you know, and that's not a story just for Saracens. It's a story for a lot of successful sports clubs, possibly a lot of successful businesses as well. So, you know, it becomes very, very competitive. And I think the biggest learning for me is that, you know, people rally around an organization. And if you built strong foundations, you know, none of our players left, you know, during that time. They stayed together as a unit, you bounce back up, and then you come back and you win a premiership. So it speaks to, I guess, the strength of an organization, its values, its culture, you know, and not to say that an organization is perfect. No one will ever achieve being perfect. But the strength of what you've built is shown at adverse times. And that's what we showed through that particular period. And I think, you know, I think actually on reflection, it was probably a necessary evil for rugby generally. You know, I was around the table when we did a deal with CVC and we sold 27% of the league for 200 million in, I think it was 2018 or 19, just before the salary cap incident. So, you know, we were trying to commercialize rugby. I've always described rugby as possibly, you know, 1 foot still stuck in the amateur days and 1 foot in the professional days. It's still got a long way to go. It needs to innovate as a sport. Look what cricket's done. And I think the whole salary cap thing was a necessary evil to try and revamp all the rules and regulations, not only for Saracens, but all the clubs and the and the league. And I think it's in a much better place now than it was 4 or 5 years ago. And I think that, that it's on a journey. And I think, you know, there's still lots to do from a commercial perspective. But certainly from a legal and governance perspective, people now understand the rules a lot better. They were rewritten, you know, over COVID. And I think we're, you know, the sport is in a better place.
Do you think, despite obviously, the outcome for Wasps and other clubs seemingly in trouble, that the outlook is bright?
I think Wasps and, you know, and Worcester were, you know, a consequence of COVID. But I think, you know, the financials of rugby need to be hugely improved on. And by that, I mean, you know, the sport needs to innovate. It needs to be, you know, it needs to be, you know, it needs to call out to a different market. You know, that potentially, you know, the game on the field needs to change. How can we get younger people involved? And all of these things are things that I know for sure that, you know, Simon Massey-Taylor at PRL, the RFU, they're kind of looking at. And, you know, I think, you know, I think there is a lot of potential there. And I think, again, I think probably Worcester and Wasps is a kind of necessary evil as a reset, you know, as a consequence of COVID, as maybe, you know, salary cap was for us in terms of revamp of regulations and governance. And I think that gives the ability or the chance for the sport to then have a reset and then be on an upward trajectory curve, which I think it can achieve, yes.
Yeah, great. You're obviously into numbers, data. You've sat in the CFO seat. Last year's theme we can't get away from is artificial intelligence and seems to carry on into 2024. How do you see that affecting the CFO and C-suite moving forward?
I think, you know, gone are the days that we make decisions by gut instinct, you know, and it's about embracing the technology and tools that are there. They are still hugely changing and evolving. But, you know, and it doesn't, from, let's say, from a CFO's perspective, it doesn't necessarily mean that you've got to be a, you know, a software engineer or a data analyst, or, you know, you need to have certain skills, you know, transferable skills. You have to be malleable, flexible. But, you know, the CFO department needs to have people who are good at data. So, you know, you would go and, you know, you would go and hire a quant or someone who is a data analyst who can then plug into your function. And then you need the people who can actually, potentially would be yourself, who can extract that data and actually understand that data and make decision making from that data. So, you know, going back to Saracens, we hired a quant from Goldman Sachs to look at all of that data on the pitch. And I think we're probably the only team that did that. And I think that gave us a competitive advantage on the pitch. So, you know, things are only going to move more and more in that direction. And I actually think it's not about, you know, getting rid of roles or making people redundant or reducing the number of people. I think it's just about embracing technology and having maybe people who are slightly more on the side of critical thinking, because they're having to analyze this data and, you know, use these decision-making tools to, or the data to make, you know, certain decisions that are going to put the business in a really good set for and then make it competitive in the market.
So at the end of Saracens, you kind of go and do some more entrepreneurial things again. It sounds like you're involved in lots of things. Where do you think you are on this kind of career journey for yourself? You know, still, as you said, mid 40s, long way to go, right? What do you want for the rest of your career or your entrepreneurial itch? You know, what's for your future?
I don't know. I don't think too much about planning the future. You know, I don't think, oh, in 5 years' time, I want to be, you know, chief exec of this, or, you know, in 5 years' time, I don't know, travel to another country and work there. Or I don't really have a... I'm more a person that believes in living in today. So, you know, and making the most of every single day. So I will go and make, you know, have contacts. I'll go and have coffees. I'll go and talk. I'll go and speak to people and just create, I guess, avenues that I can explore. And once I sit with someone and, you know, there are synergies there, I'll just go in the moment and I'll explore that. And that will lead to, for example, at the moment, I'm working with a healthcare business and looking at kind of NHS working time, waiting times, and looking at how we can use sports clubs to potentially build hubs that will, you know, have medical facilities on site, which will reduce clubs' medical costs, but also tap into reducing, you know, local NHS waiting times. So, you know, and that just came out of a conversation with someone. And so I guess to your question, Rory, I don't really think about, you know, 5 years' time. I think about what I'm doing today, how excited I am about all the different things I'm doing today. And I try and apply myself in the best possible way to what I'm doing today. And I think that's how I kind of work.
Kind of sounds like there's a mantra that's come up from another guest recently of saying yes to things, just putting yourself out there. Will you come on this podcast? Yes. You know, seeing opportunity in those.
Yeah, there is. And also, you know, a lot of people say they don't have time to do things, but... you know, maybe going back to a sports analogy, but, you know, the best players always seem to have more time on the ball. They have more time to pass. They have more time to look up and make that decision. So, you know, in some ways, business is the same thing. If you've got, you know, a diverse skill set, you can handle multiple things and there's plenty of time. You know, and I think that is just something that I've learned along the way. And you're right. I don't say no to a lot of things. Well, actually, I say no to quite a lot of kind of investment decisions and stuff around property and things. So, you know, but because I've got an analytical brain and I think about things very carefully, but I will never say no to doing the piece of work to have a look at or analyze or have a conversation about whether that thing is right or not. I'll always explore it to the best of, you know, my knowledge and my ability. And then I'll make a decision.
Back to the AI theme, are you playing around with ChatGPT now and plugging in your Excel models and interrogating it for decision-making around investments and things like that? Or is that not in your general zone?
I've tried it, but I don't think it's developed enough to you know, I think it's a way off that. Like, you know, I think it's good for certain questions and, you know, potentially, you know, writing certain emails and things like that, but there's not, as it currently stands, there's nothing better than a personal touch in terms of, you know, even if you're getting back to someone or you know, having a coffee, or you're writing back to someone, or, you know, and so I don't think it's quite there yet. Whether it will get there or not, I'm not sure. I see it more as a tool to support. And I see it more as a tool to assist rather than replicate or replace. That's how I'm using it at the moment.
Definitely.
Yeah.
There was, I don't know if you saw this week, there was a deep fake of a CFO in Hong Kong, which defrauded a company of 25 million. I think there's there's some issues for CFOs and boards now in terms of cybersecurity, fraud, etc., that must be at the forefront of people's minds, I imagine.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, just to elevate that a little bit, I mean, you know, 2024, 60 countries are going to democratic elections. You know, US, ourselves, India, China, if you can call that democratic, but you know, so that's over half of the world's population. And if you look at the trends of how people are voting, and, you know, populist votes and polarizing opinions, you know, when you have the ability to deep fake something, you know, and if that's going to drive voters to the polls and sway their, you know, their voting decisions, it's actually a scary place to be, actually, I would say. And bringing it back to the CFO level, absolutely. Like, you know, there is, you know, there things, especially listed companies, you know, things like that, it can affect share price, affect your reputation. You know, competitors can affect the reputation of, you know, someone in their industry. So I think it's really difficult. And I think these tech companies have a huge, huge part to play in regulating that and you know, ensuring that things are done properly. I think that, you know, governments are going to struggle to regulate that. And I think self-regulation is going to be the only way forward. And it's the ability, I guess it's the, it comes down to the morality of those businesses. And then that comes back full circle in terms of people. And you know, are those people decent people, honest people? Are they trying to do something that's gonna, is for the betterment of kind of humanity and society rather than just make a quick buck? And so I think that that's important to feed into kind of recruitment processes and teams that, say, if I'm a CFO, I'm trying to build my team, I'm trying to build people who are, you know, who are good people, who are honest people, that are going to be with the business for a long period of time, with, you know, solid, decent characters. And I'd like to think that if everyone is doing that and all businesses are doing that, then they'll make the right decisions overall as a kind of, as a unit.
Yeah. Is there anything you've read recently or any podcasts you've listened to recently that have shaped your thinking?
I listen to quite a few podcasts. I mean, I listen to The Rest Is Politics, which is quite an interesting one. It's kind of where I believe it's kind of a good balance, because you've got kind of Labour and Tory, kind of both sides of the coin there on with Rory and Alistair. I think, you know, Stephen Bartlett's ones, you know, Diary of a CEO is very good. You know, recently listened to kind of Thierry Henry and what he had to say through his journey. And I think it's a really good way of getting an insight into how people have developed and what they've done and their characters. And they're all quite inspiring in different ways. But the key for me is what I've learned from these things is that, you know, everyone's journey is slightly different. And the more you can expose yourself to different types of people and characters, then you're kind of building your own, you know, your own journey and your own ability to understand others. And then I think you get into this kind of the human trait of, I guess, empathy and, you know, and really building something that's not just to do with P&L and dollars and pounds, but building something that's valuable to people. And I think that's where you get real kind of balance sheet, well, intangible balance sheet value, let's call it. To bring it back to kind of
CFO. There's the finance guy inside.
Yeah.
I guess that's ultimately, like you say, people with a good moral compass. And even if your focus is on profit, it's kind of profit with purpose is really important now and probably into the future, isn't it? Given climate change and all the other things that we've got going on with AI and the risks, as we've talked about already. So it sounds like that's a focus for you in whatever you do in the future now as well.
Yeah, you know, like when I listen to these podcasts, I look at people who have built companies that, you know, that mean something in terms of, you know, and I think, you know, profit is probably a result of building something that actually is, you know, it means something to people. You know, if you build a really good food brand or tech brand or sports brand that actually, you know, appeals to people on multiple levels. And that might be social change, or it might be environment, or it might be education. You know, I think that appeals to people a lot more. And I think when you look at, you know, the leaders of the future, so, you know, for example, I education is a big thing for me. I'm a trustee of a multi-academy trust. We started a secondary school in Colindale, DfE funded. We're starting a primary school. And you know, it just gives you a better understanding of, you know, the next generation, what we're passing on to the next generation, how those skill sets are going to be developed through our UK education system. And I think it, if you're putting yourself in those shoes, then you're more likely to make a more empathetic, balanced business decision when it comes to, I know, assessing the P&L for a property project, or you know, or looking at, you know, the sports tech business, the valuation of a sports tech business. So I think it's about well-rounded people. And I think, to your point, Rory, I think, like, you know, you're really looking at people who are well-rounded and understanding the global bigger picture, rather than just focused on kind of profit and growing something and you know, and being there more, I guess, short-termism, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything unusual about you that people don't really know about?
That you can say on a podcast.
I don't think so. I think it's probably that journey around, you know, flip-flopping around things. Yeah. You know, I think that's probably quite unusual.
Yeah.
And people find it difficult to do. And it's a pain in the ass to sometimes work with and probably live with at home, to be frank. But it's something that makes me, it's part of my DNA, it's part of my character.
Yeah.
You know, when my grandparents came to this country in early 1960s, you know, they came from Kenya and they had, you know, I don't know, a couple of pounds in their pockets, and, you know, they worked two or three jobs and they had to build something in the UK and they came for a better life. And, you know, that kind of work ethic is kind of instilled in me. Mm. And a lot of them, you know, couldn't find jobs at that time, so they had to start their own businesses. And, you know, that kind of ability to, I guess, ebb and flow through life, you know, with a very strong focus on education and I guess like a professional qualification, is something that you don't often find. I think that's probably, you know, the thing that defines me most in my kind of business and career and even home life to this point, mm-hmm. I would say.
Do you worry about that as a father? I know something I think on, and I don't know if Neil does as well, but I think with the fact that you have worked hard, successful career, hopefully we've done the same, you can give your kids a lot more opportunity than maybe you had. I came from a, you know, dad owned a car garage, whatever, mum worked in a sports and leisure centre. You know, we didn't have a lot of money. And so part of that helps you build kind of grit and resilience, and our kids maybe won't have that because hopefully we've been successful and we can afford them more privileges and luxury. And I do worry about that from a, you know, generation on generation. Are we losing that kind of natural grit that our generation, I guess, had to have?
Yeah, I think that is definitely a thing. You know, I think, you know, if I just roll it back to my own example, if I take it back two generations to my grandparents who came to the country with nothing and then, you know, relocated with no job or anything, you know, I'm never going to be able to replicate that. So I think push it forward one generation and look at my kids, you know, they've got an easier life in inverted commas. I think they definitely have from a maybe a monetary perspective or a, you know, comfortable living perspective. I think what's going to be important for them is how they challenge themselves in a growing, I guess, global market. So, you know, they now have the ability, if they choose, to go and study or work in China or India or Spain or whatever it might be. And I think they have to take those opportunities. So, you know, at home, I call it, I guess you have like schooling and then you have homeschooling. But, you know, our ethos at home is to say, well, you know, push yourself, you know, do the things that you're not comfortable doing. Put yourself up for that audition. Try and involve yourself in the sports team, or, you know, try and play a musical instrument or whatever it might be. Take yourself out of that comfort zone. And I think my wife and I are always pushing the kids to try and do that. And I think that's my response to kind of the next generation being comfortable. They need to push themselves outside of their comfort zone, which won't necessarily be, you know, throw everything away and go to a country and try and start up something. Mm. But you know, whatever you can do, go and learn another language. You know, that kind of, I guess that way, that instinct to push yourself is something that we're trying to instill in our kids, which will hopefully give them resilience and learning from failure, because whatever they push themselves in, they're not going to be successful in everything. Yeah. And I think that's my kind of mantra going forward.
Yeah, no, definitely. I didn't expect the podcast to be me asking you for fatherly advice, but I absolutely appreciate
just
that.
Just don't give them any pocket money.
But I do I do think, like you say, it's an analogy for work as well, right? You know, people that we've hired, people that we continue to work with, it's about pushing yourself, taking yourself out of the comfort zone, doing the things that are uncomfortable as often as possible actually makes you better.
So, and I think, look, I think if I'm running a business, regardless of how big that is, you know, if you're going to make your next recruit, just think about the fact that, you know, you want someone that's going to give you a fresh pair of eyes, that's going to look at something left field, and is going to come in and not necessarily rip everything up. Obviously, you want stability and you want growth and you want, you know, a stable trajectory. But someone, you know, if I'm in the tech sector, if I go and hire someone from sports, you know, who's been captain of a team, a professional sports team, they're going to input a lot more than if I go and, you know, certainly a different type of input than if I go and recruit someone, you know, from C-suite sports tech business or sports or tech business. So, and I think people are doing that now. I think people are understanding that that gives you a lot more. And that's where I think the recruitment industry is shifting and probably needs to shift a bit faster and a bit quicker.
Yeah. Brilliant. Mitesh, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
And we'll hope to speak to you soon.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Nice to meet you again.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers.